Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of What a Hell of a Way to Die. You got me, Francis, we got Nate, we got Adrian. Gentlemen, how's everything going?
All's well in icy cold New York. How are you in Kiev, Adrian?
Doing all right. Yeah, can't complain.
Well, that's good. So today we are going to talk about something that the military, another thing that the military is very bad at, and that would be our military budget. Recently, Donald Trump has promised that he's going to boost the military budget, another $54 billion. We're going to get all kinds of new aircraft carriers, and it's going to be all wonderful. Lots of new war machines to go out and break down out in the middle of nowhere and then cost a whole bunch of money. So I kind of wanted to talk today. We'll talk about, military budgeting, how it's kind of fluctuated in the last, especially in during the war on terror. And just kind of ways that we've seen the military really just waste a lot of taxpayer money. I'm sure that all three of us have plenty of stories about that.
Oh, yes.
All right, Nate. Well, go ahead and start us off, Nate, since Nate and Adrian, I guess. Either one. I always start with Nate. Adrian, I don't want you to feel like you're the second ringer here.
Adrian, why don't you start? Because you were a company commander, which meant you had a property book, and you probably saw, I saw a fucking hell of a lot of it, but I imagine you also saw a bit, and you ultimately were the signatory.
Yeah, where to start? We could fill up the whole day talking about this. I think when I was a commander, the thing that got to me the most, the incident of what at the time felt like institutional fraud, waste, and abuse was there was a and thankfully I haven't thought too much about this, and time erases all negative memories eventually. We had a device called the, I think it was the ANCZY. It was a key fill for communications equipment, which had been around since the 1980s. Everybody knew how to use it. The platoon leaders knew how to use it. The platoon sergeants knew how to use it. I knew how to use it. The commo guys knew how to use it. And it was, again, like old technology. It was this black box, and it's what you
needed. It was ANCD.
There you go. Yeah. And widespread knowledge. And one day before we were about to go out on a mission, I think it was the end of 2010 or the very beginning of 2011, this contractor, the civilian, walked into my office, the command post, and said, "Hey, we've got a new device for you that's going to replace the ANCD. It's this high-tech thing, and we're gonna need you to turn in all the ANCDs, and we're gonna give you this new Palm Pilot-like device straight out of the 1990s. And we also need all of your commo guys for a week to train them on it." This was about a week before a major operation. I said, "Thank you, that's cool. We don't need that right now. I didn't ask for it, and we definitely don't need it. So why don't you come back in like a week or two? Like, this is like pretty much the worst possible time you could have picked to do this." And he said, "You should probably go talk to your battalion commander, because yeah, this is command dictated." I did, and it turned out that I had no discretion in this matter, and I lost a commo guy for a while. I couldn't spare them all, so I had the smartest commo guy go and learn how to use the thing. He learned it, and he was the one guy in the company who knew how to use it for about a month while he was training people up on this insanely complicated and, as it turned out, much more expensive device that we had just fielded. And that to me felt like a very personal and also idiotic and fruitless betrayal of everything that the war stood for. Like, I'm the commander. I'm about to do a mission. I've got a safety mechanism, which is many people in the unit know how to use this thing. Right before the mission, I'm told, "You have to take and use this piece of equipment because somebody in God knows fucking where, the Pentagon or DOD, said Raytheon has this contract for a fucking Palm Pilot. Let's dump, 10 devices at $12,000 a pop on this unit. Go ahead."
And let's pause for a second. Also, so the reader or the listeners understand, yes, the small key loader, this new device that Adrian's describing, it was the sexy Palm Pilot with Windows NT on it or whatever, but it did the same thing as an ANCD. The ANCD looked like an Atari, like a handheld Atari keyboard game from the 80s. The SKL looked like a Palm Pilot from the late 90s, but ultimately, both of them took an encryption key, put it into your radio, which basically gave the radio the sequence so that it can encrypt and free, and if you want to, frequency hop, so that your communications are scrambled and not listenable by somebody with like a, you know, like a police scanner. So ultimately, what they're saying, the point here is that the effect is the same. It's literally doing the same thing. It's just one thing is sexy and new, the other one is old. They both accomplish the same goal.
Exactly.
So just so everyone understands this, it's not as if it's like, oh, your radios are going to be more secure now. It's not like Adrian was reading out of a fucking binder of code books like from the Vietnam War, and all of a sudden it's like, no, now you just have to have this computer. It's like they're literally, it's like pausing the war to do like a software update on iTunes that is like, well, now you have hearts instead of stars on Twitter, but it's literally the same thing.
And really quickly, like the kicker here is that the time to switch out that piece of kit is not in the middle of a fucking deployment. The time to switch out that kit is when a unit is training up to go into combat. You train
because
them up.
Everything should be standardized so that they can learn on the ship they need to learn on. So that like if your fucking your commo guy like catches a bullet or steps on an IED or I don't know gets like a staph infection from too many rippets, like. Another guy can pick up from him and know how to do it.
Exactly. It was, I mean, it everything worked out in the end. There was no problem. It was just sort of inconvenient. And Beal, then Specialist Beal, who was the commo guy who figured it out first, just had to kind of do everybody's commo for a while. And we were on this major operation. And Beal became, in a weird way, the sort of like one of the priority of efforts. It's just sort of like, okay, we've got an hour and a half, and I need to get Beal somehow. Like, we need to mount combat patrols to move Specialist Beal from position 1, 2, 3, and then 4 to get all of the platoons on the right frequency. So this is, you know, like crazy. Crazy.
And people should understand that when you have COMSAT, or communication security, the key that we're describing is typically changed out once a week. Sometimes the master, like at the battalion level, is changed out once per month, but you get a new key basically once a week, I think. Maybe sometimes you can have less frequent, but as far as I understand, depending on your standing operating procedure, it's normally changed out every 7 days. So every 7 days, you have to fiddle fuck all these radios and install the new key. It's a lot more challenging when somebody's trying to use a small key loader versus... an ANCD, which they just know how to use better.
More frequently, if somebody at Brigade happens to do something stupid and suddenly that requires an entire theater-wide commo.
a guy lost a radio in Kandahar when I was in Afghanistan, which is not even the same province, not even the same regional command. It's RC South. I was in RC East, but everybody in theater in, and not just theater, like Afghanistan theater, but like U.S. Central Command theater. So in Iraq, in Kuwait, in Qatar, in Bahrain, in Yemen, in fucking Somalia when dudes were fucking doing secret squirrel shit, everyone had to reset their CompSec. So I want to tell my army budget, military budget story.
Go for it.
I think you have to understand that everything about military property in general is arbitrary in terms of its cost, its value. And what Adrian just described is very common, that the priority oftentimes, it feels like as a soldier, as an infantryman, you know, going ready to do a mission, you find yourself weirdly pulled off of your normal task to support like a contract from a contractor to field a new piece of equipment or to use a certain piece of equipment. And so what Adrian just described, like I knew the story was going to happen before he even said it, when he's like, let's delay this. Typically, like those guys are on tour going around the country installing these things. And so like you basically have no choice. You have to accept it. I saw a thing in Afghanistan that really blew my mind about property. I mean, I saw a lot of property things that blew my mind. I mean, we could go on all day about property, army property stories and absurd things that happened. But I think the one that really blew my mind was there was this device that was created specifically for Iraq. It was, you know, in the sort of government contractor, defense contractor explosion that took place after the global war on terror started. There was this device that they came up with called the Boomerang. It's not a funny Eddie Murphy movie from the 90s. It's a big ball of fucking microphones. It looks like the bumble ball. Remember the bumble balls in the 90s? The toys for kids that like the ball with little foam things that jiggled and rolled on the floor? It looked like one of those, except it was mounted on a pole on the top of your Humvee. And basically it would use a series of microphones to triangulate the point of origin of a sniper round. So if someone's taking pot shots at you, the boomerang hears it and it feeds it into its little fucking pocket calculator computer, and then gives you a an estimated like azimuth, so a compass direction on where it thinks the rounds are coming from. And one of the problems that you were having in Iraq was snipers, you know, sniper discipline is such they typically only take one shot when they're in a position. So sniper fires at you, maybe it hits your driver or your gunner, maybe it hits the vehicle itself, who, you know, God hope no one dies, no one gets hurt. But if it happens, a lot of times people are like, oh my God, a guy just got hit, where the fuck did it come from? And some people heard the shot, but nobody knows, and it's a city or it's a moderately urbanized area, so it's like, you don't know. So this makes sense in a vehicle, right? So the same company, flush with success from having manufactured this bumbleball microphone on your vehicle, decides that it wants to field this new device called the SWAT. I don't know what the SWAT stands for. I was so mortified by this that I kind of blanked out. The SWAT is the same concept, a microphone that triangulates sniper fire. The problem is, they're like, oh, but this one's for dismounted personnel. You wear it on your body. Now, here's the problem, right? Think about this for a second. It's going to tell you where the round was coming from, assuming you stand fucking still when a sniper is shooting at you. And it's going to tell you where the round is coming from. But if you move your position, like, and suddenly you run 10 meters in a different direction, 180 degrees azimuth is still going to be in a different area than 180 degrees azimuth from where you were standing in the first place. Hmm. So it's like a 7-pound battery pack and a wearable microphone that's going to tell you, like, oh, now the microphone's telling me where I'm getting shot at from. It doesn't fucking make any sense. And so guess what they did? They bought enough that literally every fucking soldier in the goddamn battalion could wear one. And I'm sure these things were valued at over $1,000 a piece, probably way more than that. So you factor in, there's like 750 people in an airborne infantry battalion. So we get these things in shipping containers, and they sit in goddamn shipping containers, and nobody ever takes them out. Because why the fuck would you? It's the stupidest thing in the world. But the Army bought them, the Army fielded them, we had them. And meanwhile, it's like, do we have enough money to like buy a new MRAP or like get a new MRAP fielded to us? Because like ours got blown up. And they're like, no, that's coming in a couple of months, but you still have to go on patrols. So it's like you find yourself in this weird situation downrange where you're like flush with expensive shit you don't need, but then you can't get stuff that you actually want, like getting new vehicles.
You know, John Ismay, my roommate at Columbia Journalism School, who was working for public radio out in L.A. for a while and is currently with Amnesty International, had for a long time his big kick was places where the military was going for low-tech solutions, or there were competitive low-tech solutions that soldiers were asking for, and getting fielded high-tech devices of questionable utility instead. And that just sounds like, it makes me wonder, how many times were there units that said, we don't need this, thank you? Like, did that ever happen? Was there ever a colonel that was just like, this is, no. You know, take this back. What are you guys thinking?
Actually, there was. I think in 2012, it was Petraeus who kept saying, stop making tanks. We don't need tanks. We don't need M1 Abrams tanks. We have plenty of tanks. Stop making them because they're just sitting on, you know, spend the money elsewhere.
Stateside. Well, the same thing with Humvees. I mean, like,
like a bad call.
Do senators run it down, you know, the Congress people run it down the government's throat that they're like, we need more AM General Humvees. And it's like, well, maybe, but we have lots and lots of Humvees that we can't use downrange because we have to use MRAPs, because if you drive in Humvees and they get fucking hit by a 500-pound IED, everybody inside is vaporized. So we were in theater and we had lots of Humvees and we weren't able to use them. That's not to say we'll never need Humvees ever again. And that's not to say that the MRAP is like the choice platform for the future, because it's not. But it's weird. It's very strange to see these sorts of things happen where the decisions are made because a defense contractor got a contract, or, you know, senators have factories in their districts and want these things to be made. And so, or not their districts, their states. And so you see this kind of stuff happen.
Well, that's exactly what it was with the tanks. The M1 Abrams tanks were made in one factory in Ohio. And whoever was the rep there or the senator there said, no, we're not going to put these people out of a job. These people need to have a job. So you're going to keep, and, you know, rather than retrofitting it, rather than saying, okay, well, now we make MRAPs, or now we make, you know, the new armor transport, or now we make literally anything else that the military uses on a regular basis, because tanks are fucking useless in Iraq, as we've discovered.
Something I want to point out, too, though, is that this is kind of like what made me a socialist. I mean, really, this really is. the absurdity of the war we were fighting was one thing, but this was really it, because to me, I realized that these Humvees that we were blowing up nonstop for or worse, bringing to combat and then being told, oh yeah, they're not safe. You're like, you're just going to park them in a fucking parking lot on Fob Sharana. They're worth $300,000 each. Seeing this happen, seeing over and over again this, the sheer waste, I just was like, we have the money to do things to help Americans who need help, but we don't want to. Like, basically, this thought occurred in my mind when I was downrange, that literally the government makes up numbers and they're monopoly money until they hit your bank account, and then they're real money and you can buy things with them. And it's like $300,000 fucking Humvees are monopoly money on paper, but they actually, if you steal a Humvee from the army and sell it for scrap, they're going to hit you with a statement of charges for $300,000. I watched a guy have to pay $2,400 for a fucking stupid Dell laptop that got lost, and it was from like 2002. And on the like, if you looked up on eBay or on Newegg or any of these places, it was worth like $70. But the government's like, nope, we paid $2,400 for it. You're paying us $2,400 for it. I mean, I was able to beat the statement of charges because it turned out to be bullshit. But at one point, was facing a charge on a RT-1523 Alpha Sinkar's radio from like the early 90s, and they were saying it was worth like $5,000. I mean, who knows, maybe it is. It's worth $5,000 to like military memorabilia collectors, but in terms of its actual value, it's not worth a fucking goddamn thing. And so it's just shocking to see this. Like, I think the overvaluation of things, the inflation of costs, the numbers of civilian contractors involved in the process, the extent to which things are contracted and outsourced and bloated, and then when you even break down like the amount of these hundreds of billions of dollars that get spent every year in defense appropriations, they're not soldiers on the ground, and seamen and airmen and Marines and people in the Coast Guard, they don't even really see the stuff that much. Like, there's a guy, I want to say it was
sailors,
Brandon.
Sailors.
They are seamen, though. Damn, guys.
Wait. Okay, let me jump in really quickly, because I think you made a great point there when you talked about the statements of charges, which is that, and this is one of the things that helped me move to the left, is that the contractors, especially the biggest contractors, are the ones who have almost no responsibility when something sucks or is just even completely useless. But for the individual soldier, oh, heaven help you. If you have, even if your paperwork is messed up, you're going to get hit. The boom is going to get lowered on private first class so-and-so's head. There seems to me like something terribly unjust when a $10 million contract can get written off, or even, you know, the billions of dollars that disappeared in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a complete write-off. But Private Snuffy, oh man, you know, he's Article 15, statement of charges, hook him up. You know, hook the little guy up.
I had to do a financial liability investigation of property loss for a kid who lost a sleeping bag in Iraq because he tried to mail it to himself through MPS and it got stolen. I had to do another flipple on a kid who went AWOL and got found in Alaska like 6 years later, and all of his bags had gotten raided from the cage room in his company, and the army decided that on the way out of giving him a prison sentence for desertion, because they were being hard in 2011 in ways they weren't in, say, 2007. They also charged him for like $1,500 of his what's the word, TA-50. So, I mean, yeah, exactly, Adrian. I mean, the individual soldier gets steamrolled for the cost of, you know, $100 fucking canteen. But like you said, the things like the failure to deliver on the Comanche helicopter or victory in Iraq gets completely written off. I'll tell you another story, too, that's amazing to me, absolutely amazing to me, when it comes to how the property system in the military gets so convoluted. I mean, everybody who's ever worked on the line knows that, you know, your supply sergeant can make miracles happen. You just don't want to know how the miracles happened. You don't want to know where it comes from, because if you know where it comes from, then you're probably liable in some capacity. You're complicit in the conspiracy, because the military property system, I mean, like, it's just it's strange in the sense that, if I remember correctly, the definition of what constitutes the valuation of an expendable item, which is just an arbitrary classification in its own right. What's an expendable item, an item that can be destroyed without financial, basically, like, if it's lost, if it's damaged, you don't have a statement of charges because it's considered replaceable, goes up to like $5,000. So I've seen it, for example, where there was an ordering code, a national stock number, and Adrian, help me out, man. You were a company commander. What were the things called? It was like a 6-digit code or whatever, like the UIC or something. No, that's your unit.
Well, there's the NSN.
NSN, and then there's something else too. But anyway, like there was something that was unlocked when I was in Afghanistan, and you could literally buy a 60-inch HDTV, and it was considered an expendable item. Because they had tried to lock down all of the NSN, so like people in theater weren't ordering them, but this one was open, and so basically there'd be no penalty paid if you ordered it. Like, so I knew a couple of supply sergeants. They went to their company commanders. They're like, "Hey, we could get like a TV. We could use it as like a monitor for briefings." And so like, yeah, they bought like one or two TVs, and like it worked out. You know, they had a TV in the battalion talk or the company talk, but they found out that our supply support activity, the chief property officer, had ordered like a shipping container full of TVs, and the plan was she was going to like steal them and take them home to Alaska. And had that gotten back to Alaska, like none of that would have been accountable, because that's the property system, the way that it works. Like there's a certain amount budgeted, and you can, especially when you're downrange, you could order whatever the hell you wanted. So like, yeah, there was literally a person who ordered a 20-foot container full of TVs, and had they not had to reduce the number of containers being shipped back to Alaska from Afghanistan, she probably would have walked away with 50 fucking TVs. It's insane. I mean,
now let me go ahead and piggyback off of that, because my expenditure story actually comes from my former commander, who was one of the last PAO units that was in Iraq, and he was telling me, so all those TVs that showed up in Iraq, including all of these things that were, as you said, you know, couldn't be really held accountable for because they had these open NSN numbers. What they did with those, whether it was fresh in the box, whether it had been used once, whether one general had it put up and saw a PowerPoint on it for 5 minutes and then it never got turned on again, whether it came to camera equipment, especially public affairs, what they do with all this stuff, because it is cheaper, it is too expensive to ship it home and have nothing to do with it. Because, you know, ship it home, your supply cages don't have that, and you have to empty out all these containers. So what he said that they were doing, like when they were getting ready to ship, you know, video cameras and still cameras home, they went up and they said, okay, we've got these cameras to ship home, which, you know, where do you want us to put them? And they said, pull all the batteries out, put the batteries over here in this pile, and then put all of the equipment over in that, on that big concrete pad full of everything else, all these other electronics, all these electronics you're talking about. And he said, that doesn't look like a way that you're going to ship it home. What are you doing out there? And the guy said, oh, we're going to dump JP-8 on it and set it all on fire. No. Because it's too expensive.
God.
Yeah, it's too expensive to take home. So they're taking the batteries out for safety, you know, got to be safe. But all of the rest of this stuff, if it is too expensive to take home, or it's just not cost effective, or we have, you know, the FOO money. What does FOO stand for? Fuck, I don't remember.
Federal operating. I don't know. Yeah, I know what you're talking.
Basically,
about.
I know what you mean. Basically, though, yeah. Army petty cash, basically.
Funds ordering officer. The FOO is the funds ordering officer. Yeah.
So that's that would be SERP that you're talking about. The
commander's the FOO. Emergency relief. The FOO controls the commander's emergency relief program, which is SERP money. Yeah.
Right. So, but what it all comes down to is that's what they did. And my commander is like, these are, you know, the cameras that he had is like, these cameras are very difficult for PAO to get a hold of.
Here's the thing, though. Francis, here's the thing, though, right? If your commander smuggled them back, then he committed a crime. If he set them all on fucking fire, then he did the right thing, according to the Army. That's the insanity of it all. And you could probably FOI, they're found on installation, those things, and put them on your own property book. It's not like they're unaccountable and they can be stolen. But, like, that's the thing, is that everything from ammunition that, like, it's too difficult for people to do paperwork. So what they did in Afghanistan was just write expenditure reports for all their ammunition, even if it wasn't actually expended. So you had, like, I found shipping containers full of unaccountable ammunition, like thousands and thousands. Like, I literally, one time there was a container in the middle of our yard, and I finally popped the lock because no one knew who owned it. We opened it up, and it had, like, 350 cases of 120-millimeter white phosphorus rounds. And it was, like, literally 100 meters from our battalion talk, like just sitting out in the open, just like, oh, I hope a mortar doesn't land on this. You know what I mean? Yep. Like,
I had a guy who told me that they were digging a motor pool at a FOB and they hit something and they ended up upending a container full of unpacked saws, 249s,
oh my
that
God.
Were just buried because the paperwork was lost. And it's like, if and in the military, you live and die by your paperwork. If you don't have the paperwork for it, you need to create it, or you need to figure out something to do with it. Now, I question that story a little bit. That guy is a little bit of a storyteller, but I also do not 100% say that there's absolutely no way that didn't happen.
I mean, I remember I would ride my little John Deere Gator on Fob Sharana up to this container yard where all the containers were just like basically abandoned and left unlocked, and you'd find everything from building materials and class 4 construction materials to like, I found an entire mobile fuel point that was still in its packing crates, and I happened to just write down the NSN on it and look it up, and it was worth like $400,000 just sitting there, like nobody's using it, like it was dry rotting on the wood. I want to tell a quick story. Because this is when I thought about property, I realized what was the most ridiculous property story I ever had. Because it's so depressing to think of what you just described, Francis. Because I'm like, hey, millennials listening, there's your future. There's the impossibility of getting free college and $15 minimum wage and healthcare and all these things because we needed to buy a camera and TV for every American and then set it on fire in Iraq.
Yeah, and if anybody out there has an angry racist uncle that screams about welfare queens, have them take a listen to this, because these are all true stories. This is what the government
does.
Here's
my true story. A lot of commanders are fucking idiots about property. And Adrian, I'm sure you've met commanders like this. And so when you go to a brigade, you know, a brigade in the Army has about between 3,000 and 4,000 soldiers, depending on its type. And so when each soldier belongs to a company, and you figure there's probably about 6 companies on average in a battalion, so that's 6 company commanders in each battalion, and a brigade probably has, you know, 6 battalions. So, you know, you have anywhere from 30 to 36 company commanders, then you have administrative commanders, so you probably have like a solid 40 company commanders in a brigade. Let's just be honest. That's spitball math, but... So the property book office has to control the property books of every one of those 40 companies, and all 40 of those company commanders are signed for it. So every month, those commanders have to sign a form saying they've inventoried a certain percentage of their property, and they've inventoried 100% of all their sensitive items, like their weapons, their optics, their night vision glasses, that kind of thing. So what you find is that commanders are busy, commanders are dumb, oftentimes, commanders trust their supply sergeants. So depending on how rigorous a person is, depending on how curious they are about learning about the property, you might have some commanders who actually know what their property looks like, and you might also have some who just literally sign their inventory slips every month, not knowing what the fuck they have and what it looks like. Case in point. I can't remember the nomenclature exactly. It was like the ANGRK-50 or GYK-50 or something like that. It was a device. Didn't know what it was. It was worth $300,000. It had a serial number. We were supposed to put it in left behind equipment, which meant it was stored by civilians in the States. It was taken off our property books while we were deployed. Well, I wasn't sure if it was in left behind equipment or not. I went and asked my company commander when I was an executive officer, and he said, oh yeah, the airplane door. And I said, wait, we have an airplane door and it's worth $300,000? And he says, well, yeah, see, so this unit, you know, was stood up in the 80s, and we still used C-141 Starlifter. And so, like, the Starlifter had this thing where you actually had, like, an antenna inside an airplane door. You could put it as, like, a replacement door, and that way the airborne commander could talk to, like, his subordinate units, because, like, that way the antenna would hook up to your radio, and so, like, your manpack radio could hook up to this airplane door antenna. And I'm thinking, like, this doesn't fucking sound right. Like, we don't have C-141 Starlifters anymore. Like, maybe in the guard somewhere, but this is crazy. Why would it still be on the property book? He's like, no. I've seen it before. When I did my inventories, it exists. Go look at the airplane door. That's what you're looking for. And so I was like, okay. Went to the civilians. They opened up this 40-foot container packed full of all this equipment we weren't taking, like sleds, like Akio sleds full of Arctic equipment and skis and ski poles and all this shit. Climb in the back of all this fucking Arctic nonsense to find the airplane door that supposedly was worth $300,000 and is an antenna for a C-141. And I find a random-ass door with a serial number Dremel tooled into it. Like someone took a Dremel tool and carved it in. And I'm like, this cannot fucking be right. What's happening? But I was like, I told my company commander, hey, I found it. All right, we're good. And I'm thinking to myself, what the fuck is this thing? So I write down the information and I get my supply sergeant to dig it up. And I come to find he was able to get in touch with senior property people to find me like all the technical manuals for this thing. The ANGYQ50 or whatever the fuck it was It's the talk router. It's the router system that is installed in your tactical operating center that lets you have a couple of radios, but have them routed to handsets, where like little digital handsets where you can talk. Like anybody sitting at a workstation can control the radio. That's what it was. But the company commander was so convinced it was this fucking airplane door that his soldiers were like, okay, whatever. Like, commander thinks it's a door. They grabbed the random spare door from our installation property book, Dremel tooled a serial number into it, and were like, here it is, sir. Here's your airplane
door.
Wow.
Holy shit.
So he'd been inventorying this fucking airplane door for a year, thinking it was this $300,000 goddamn piece of equipment that you could fucking talk to other airplanes. And it was literally just a plain-ass door with a serial number carved into it.
But did you have that communication equipment too?
We did. It had been shipped to Afghanistan because we needed it. Right. And nobody was talking to each other.
God. Yeah, so, you know, that's another. Well, I guess that's a little bit. We could have an entire episode dedicated to the property book and the vicissitudes and vagaries of property book management. But because, you know, the thing about that is the weird thing there to me is sort of like, and I spent 19 months as an XO before I was a company commander. And I was the XO of a line airborne company and then the easy company or the maintenance company. So I got it good. I got it good.
Yeah, you had
and
a
I
lot
got
of property.
It, I got it deep. And I helped out. I helped outload Easy and therefore the other companies from Afghanistan. And boy, anyway, there's a system there, and you know it's really, really complicated. But you've got, you know, warrant officers that know it, and you have supply sergeants who end up being subject matter experts, and there are people who can help guide you through the system. And although it is needlessly arcane and Byzantine, like Byzantine is the best word to describe that system, you can just imagine like what it would be like organizing property if you didn't have it. I mean, that Byzantine system that was probably designed in the 1960s or the 1970s is far better than the nothing at all, although it probably is that definitely in need of overhaul. But so, like, just to get back to the mismanagement, not of property, but overall, just like a procurement. People are talking about, we need to spend money on the budget, and we need a big budget this, and we need, you know, we need this, we need that. And one of the anecdotal stories I have that I'd like to share is a story of how people were training in the late 1990s when there was no budget, when the budget was like really hard to get money for anything. And if you had a live fire exercise, that was probably going to be like, that was the highlight of your, if not your career, then like your time as a lieutenant or your time as a company commander. It was a huge deal because people became very inventive about training. They put, from what I understand from people who were battalion commanders when I was lieutenant colonels and majors when I was a lieutenant, what they were doing instead of shooting, what they were doing instead of, you know, jumping every day unless they were in the 82nd, was they were doing a lot of really inventive and innovative training, like capture the flag and, you know, 25-mile ruck marches and things that were very challenging but caused people to think, land nav courses that were immersive. It's not like we've never faced this before. And let's not forget that the military that came out of that, the military that came out of the austere 1990s, was the very military that was so capable and easily took down the Taliban and Iraq. And it's not because they got tons of money and tons of fat to chew on every day. It's because they were lean and they were mean and they were adaptable. And it was the wrong war. I mean, we never should have gone into Iraq. That was one of the dumbest wars we've ever done, if not the. That might just be the dumbest war we ever did. But the military that fought in that war was also one of the best militaries that we've ever had. And I think that that capability is inversely proportional to the amount of money they had. They didn't have a lot of money. They ended up being very capable. Had they had more money to go fuck around, I don't know that they would have been more capable. I think Raytheon would have made a lot more money. Raytheon stock would have been higher. I'm sure we would have fired a lot more bullets beforehand, but would we have been better? I don't know. Or TOW missiles. Exactly. Well, we did,
I mean,
okay.
I make the argument, you know, my dad served in the military in the 70s when it was really bad after Vietnam. And then in the 80s when they got more funding and they trained up, like they rebuilt the military in a lot of ways. And the 90s were a drawdown, like you said, but they did actually train innovatively. And it's like, imagine an axe that was dulled from poor maintenance, and then they spent 30 years rebuilding it, stropping it and burnishing it and sharpening it and getting it all the way back to like premium condition. And then they're like, all right, guys, this axe is sharp as fuck. Let's cut down a metal telephone pole with it. And that's that was the Iraq War.
Yeah, I think what I tell people mostly is that it's not that the military needs more money. I mean, we spend more on our defense than the next seven countries combined. We need to be smarter about how we spend money. We need to, I feel like it's one of those, like, I really am more into the military taking care of the military and leaving the politicians as far out of it as we can, because that's when we get, fleets of M1 Abrams tanks that we don't need. We don't need $54 billion more. We need to figure out what the fuck we're doing with the F-35. We need to stop building more aircraft carriers. We have like 12. The next
we have more than
most amount of people is one. Like, I think England has one. China has one. We have 12.
Well, the carrier, Russia has one and a barge. Russia's also got a barge.
A friend of mine, his dad was in the military in the 60s and then has become very successful financially, but he also has become like rightward of Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly levels of intense conservatism. And he's always going about like, it's treason that they cut the military budget, blah, blah, blah. And my friend's a Green Beret, and he's told his dad, and I don't know if his dad listens, but his argument is like, look, you had four kids. When you give a kid an allowance, like $5 is appropriate, maybe $20 is appropriate, but you don't give them a $10,000 a month allowance. What the fuck do you think they're going to spend it on if you do? And he's like, that to him is the military. And he's like, he's been through, he was in the SFQ course when the sequester hit, and like all of a sudden they didn't have bullets. But like, the fact is, we spend so much on it, what we get for it isn't demonstrably better, and we are poorer as a civil society because we spend so much on it.
Yeah.
And that to me, I think, like, I don't know what else you can say about it. Like, I could do 25-mile ruck march instead of having to like jump out of planes. Like, it is what it is. I've seen it happen in places where we had money, where we didn't have money. The fact is, you can still train soldiers. You can still train soldiers if you're training with fucking blank rounds or no rounds in a glass house. You can train them. It's a matter of, do you want to train them, or do you think like you need money and fucking fireworks and special effects to actually train soldiers? And if you think that's true, you're probably a weak leader.
Good place.
Every Republican that screams that liberals just want to throw money at a problem until it goes away, I mean, that's exactly what you're doing with the military. All right, guys, I think that's a good spot to end it. Just a note for our listeners, I'm going to try to do kind of like a weekly column as well to link up with this, and maybe I'll get Nate and Adrian too as well, since all three of us are writers, I feel like we should probably write on occasion, expound on things, or maybe have other things that we put out. I know, Adrian, you just posted the thing on Wrath-Bearing Tree that I thought was really good about arming the left. So we'll kind of keep an eye out for that. Did you have something you wanted to add?
I got something ready to drop about valorizing President Bush through his weird and creepy painting fetish. Keep your eyes peeled for that.
Somebody fucking needs to. All right, everybody, until next week, thank you for listening, and we'll see you then.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.